Hello and welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast.
Welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast with your host, Amrit Sander. So the topic of this week's podcast is all about stress. We have organizations trying to navigate the uncertain world that we're now in, trying to develop a new strategy to mitigate some of the risks that we find ourselves facing. We have leaders and managers trying to inspire and lead their teams whilst at the same time trying to make sense of their own emotions. And we have employees worried about whether they still have a job. So we find the world of work hugely stressful. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better soon. So we need to understand stress better and to understand how we can mitigate some of the impact of stress. And who better than to discuss this with me than our guest today, Professor Daryl O'Connor from Leeds University. Daryl is a friend of the organisation. We've worked together for many years and he's an absolute expert in this field. So Professor Daryl O'Connor, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, great to be here indeed.
So Daryl, before we get into the whole topic of stress and understanding more about it and our relationship with it, I would love to know more about you firstly, your background and your you know, what you've done.
Absolutely. So I'm a health psychologist and professor of psychology at the University of Leeds. And I suppose I define myself as an individual who's interested in understanding health psychological processes, particularly from a bio or a psychobiology point of view, trying to understand how psychological variables impact on our biology, on our health, and on our behavior. And I suppose I've been interested in, as a psychological scientist for many years, on the links between what we know and call the biopsychosocial model and how this impacts on our well-being and health and longevity. And I say, I suppose I've got 25 years experience working particularly in the area of stress as well as other areas, but particularly I suppose I consider myself a stress expert, someone who's spent a lot of time researching the processes and understanding why it is some people experience stress in particular ways and others don't experience stress at all, and also who's vulnerable, who isn't vulnerable, and who's resilient. So I suppose that's pretty much me. I'm a health psychologist with a psychobiological background.
And we've had the privilege of working with you as an organization for a number of years now, and the insights you bring every time to some of the work we do has been fantastic, and that's why I wanted to get you on the show today to understand stress much more. You talked about the individual reaction to stress, and before we dive into to talking about that detail, how would you summarize what stress is?
I mean, Amrit, that's a really helpful and useful starting point. It's important to clarify that, because to many people, I mean, stress is part of our everyday life. It's used in our vernacular. We talk about being stressed. We talk about stressors. So there's a lot of kind of mess, to put it quite simply, in how we understand that. But the reason is because it's a really complex phenomenon. But stress ultimately is a psychological construct, and it impacts on every one of us in a different way. And I suppose what's important is to be clear, what's at the heart of stress is what's called cognitive appraisal. So the idea is that stress is probably, in my mind, best described as it only arises under situations where an individual perceives there are demands in their environment that they do not perceive again that they've got the resources to meet. And when there's a mismatch between those demands and those resources, that is when we experience stress. And that's both biologically, psychologically, and behaviorally. So it's really important that we understand that, because by understanding that stress is ultimately an appraisal, a reaction, or what we call in stress theory, it's a transaction between the individual and their environment. And at the heart of that, as I say, is appraisal. So if we understand that appraisal's at the center, that also gives us a little, really important inroad into how we might intervene and help people cope better in their everyday lives with stress.
So that individual appraisal would imply then actually, because we're going through a huge period of uncertainty, and we've got leaders, managers who are meant to be navigating organizations through this turbulent time. And we've got employees who are sat there worried about the future. And I guess then there's a risk that if the manager or leader feels quite comfortable with where things are at the moment, there's a risk they might miss that the individual individuals in their teams are feeling stressed because they're not, we're perceiving stress differently as individuals.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a really good point, Amrit. I mean, I suppose to my mind, well, there's two issues come to mind. One is the reduction of uncertainty is key, right? We know that as human beings, we have we strive for reductions in uncertainty, and that can also trigger stress. We know this when we manage any change scenario, that should be central. And also what's crucial is to give information to help reduce that uncertainty. I mean, if you look at, it's interesting, some of the government messaging, but also some of organizational messaging. And the organizations are doing this well are the ones who are regularly sending updates to staff. You know, similarly in government, giving updates to the population. And both of those are entirely motivated to reduce uncertainty. But the other thing which is worth reflecting on is, you're right, we're all dealing with these incredibly uncertain times. These are it's unprecedented. I mean, I like to describe it as we're basically dealing with the greatest biopsychosocial emergency of the century. We've never faced anything like this. And that has lots of consequences on everything that we do, from working right through to socializing, travel, parenting, education, etc. But coming back to the work environment and to stress specifically. So one of the key psychological theories is about this appraisal. And we argue there's two types of appraisal. There's this thing called primary appraisal. And primary appraisal is this thing that you nearly do subconsciously. And primary appraisal is made up of three components. It's the evaluation of threat, loss, and challenge. So when something noxious happens in your environment, that could be a change in your environment, like the pandemic or government restrictions or having no medication or not uncertain about the future of your work. Any of these things happen, we make an appraisal and we decide, is this threatening to me? We don't sit there and think to yourself, oh, is this threatening? This is a really split second sort of appraisal process. And we think, what sort of loss is there likely to come to us if this comes to fruition? But the other thing is, we also, in a simultaneous interacting process, engage in what's called secondary appraisal. And secondary appraisal is what we call coping. So that's the extent to which we evaluate whether or not we've got the resources to help mitigate the demands or the threat or the loss that might come our way. So a really good example of this might be something like, if you've got a forthcoming presentation at work, your boss says to you, right, you have to give this big presentation in 2 weeks' time. You might immediately find that very threatening. But actually, at the same time, you might think, but it's okay. I've done lots of preparation for that presentation already. I've been at all the relevant meetings. I know exactly the relevant statistics linked to that talk. And therefore, you may not experience that as stressful at all because your resources, your perceptions of resources are meeting the demands. And this can happen in any aspect of our life. But the other thing which is really important when we're dealing with uncertain times is, again, coming back to appraisal. So I mentioned primary appraisal earlier. But one of the crucial things is the idea of challenge. So what many people do, and certainly what I encourage anyone who's willing to listen to do, when you're faced with something you believe is a stressful scenario, why don't you reappraise it? You reappraise it and you see it as a challenge. So it could be the exam, it could be the presentation. You might think instead, hey, this isn't going to be a problem. This is an opportunity for me to show how good I am. Or this is an opportunity for me to show that I've worked really hard. So as a result of, you know, modifying your appraisals, that will also have an impact on that overall primary appraisal and will also reduce the likelihood that you experience stress.
So this is, you've actually, I feel like you've opened a huge Pandora's box here for leaders and managers, in the sense that if I'm leading a team, how would I ever go about understanding and helping them navigate through stress? Because it's so individualized, their perception, their appraisal, and their response. And as a leader, I'm trying to help them through this, as well as dealing with my own appraisal of my environment around me. So at an organizational level, you start to then think, how would we ever get people through uncertain times like this? You know, what mechanism would an organization implement?
Well, actually, there's a number of immediate things and fairly straightforward things that organizations can do. So what I was describing just now was the idea that, you know, stress, these daily events or large events, small events, which are central to understanding how the stress process. But we also see, if they understand, that stress also happens in the wider context. One of the greatest stressors that we all experience is linked to our work. So job stress, occupational stress, job strain, however you describe it, is probably for most people the primary cause of stress-related illness, depression, and anxiety, if we look at it in the whole. So what we know is there's a number of really key models of stress in the workplace, which will come right into their own in times of uncertainty, like we are currently going through. And I've alluded to some of the things you can do earlier. But what we know is that a good work environment is what's called an active work environment. So these are jobs which have got high levels of job control and also high levels of demand. So it's okay to have a demanding job, as long as that accompanies high levels of job control. But within the context of stress theory, we don't just describe it as job control, we call it decision latitude. And decision latitude has two components. One is skill discretion and actually decision-making over what you actually do on a day-to-day basis. So what we know is that jobs which have both those components are also jobs which allow people to learn learn new skills, much more engaged with many different with their job and how they respond and how they cope. So they need to learn a new skill to cope with uncertainty. They're able to do that. But again, those are perceptions, right? Decision latitude and job control are both objective but subjective. So it's really important that from a manager's point of view, that A, you ensure that you provide your employees with opportunity to decide when they work and how they work, so within reason, of course. But offering that increased levels of latitude over what they do on a day-to-day basis is likely to mitigate negative effects of the changing environment, which is demanding for the employee. But the other really important thing I think you need to remember is that in this key model, which is known as the Karasek model, the job demands control model, it has a third component, which is called support. And what we know is that support in the workplace is one of the most powerful tools you can introduce. So, Amit, you're talking about what can employees or employers do and line managers do and senior executives do. Well, one crucial thing is they can offer support. And that can be both through co-worker support. So you set up buddy schemes within your workplace to help colleagues support going through change and stress. But you also can ensure that line management is supportive. It's done in a way which is working in collaboration. And then also senior leaders can really set examples by talking about the importance of seeking support. So what we know is that jobs which have high levels of decision latitude, high levels of support, co-worker and line manager support, and also have reasonably high levels of demands, are those optimal active jobs which are likely to yield better productivity. But what we do know is it yields much better job satisfaction, increased levels of creativity, but also you have a healthier, happier workforce.
That beautifully flows into what we do in our work, where we're now in this huge uncertainty. We're trying to get organizations to involve more people in the decision-making. So we now know leaders don't have a strategy. Nobody has a strategy. So therefore, let's get people involved to co-create and allow them to apply their skills that they may not have had a chance to apply in the siloed jobs that we put them in, to help create a better future. So that really, really resonates with me. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the other really interesting thing that you say there, if we just broaden us out again to the current COVID-19 pandemic, which psychological scientists have been doing a huge amount of work and trying to understand how best to mitigate and help societies recover in all aspects of our lives. But one of the real powerful take-home messages to my mind is the idea of collectivizing as opposed to individualizing. And the idea that we becomes much more important than I. And actually, if you look at the early part of the pandemic, and also we can broaden this out to other disasters and other emergencies in the past, but you know that where you get the greatest responses is when there's a community and a collective spirit We're all in this together. And actually, the other key message, I think, is that, and we know as psychological scientists, that's the sort of message that organizations should be getting out there. So it should be, we all recognize that this is tough. And we're all trying to do this together, from right at the top of the organization, from your senior executives, right to your line managers and all employees. So key point is, if we promote the we will increase the well-being and productivity and creativity of workforces during these really uncertain times, I would imagine.
Perfect. So that's the way organizations can navigate this. I want to take it back to now the individual again, from the perspective of sometimes the language we can get into the habit of using. So sometimes, you know, I talk to people and you say, well, how's everything? And oh, I'm just a little bit stressed at the moment. And I wonder how much of that, whilst it might be a flippant comment to say, you know, I say out of habit, does that have an impact on our perception of how we've appraised the environment, or is that just, it's a habit, as long as the individual doesn't put too much weight on the word stress, it doesn't matter. It's their view of what their world is, and therefore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. I mean, that to me brings us right back to that really key point, is it helps you understand the individual differences in the stress process. And you're right, you will respond entirely to all sorts of stimuli around you. So that could be, you're right, well, not other individuals label a particular thing as stressful, whereas you may not find it stressful. But I think the crucial thing is that we often, you know, the world has changed over the last 20, 30 years, which is the idea that stress is all around us. I think it's not even about the language so much. It's the fact is that the type and nature of stressors have changed, and the way we work has changed. The fact is that the blurring between the home-work interface is, I think, pretty alarming and damaging. And so any individual, everyone around us is impacting us in that regard. And I'm more concerned about those sort of issues. Ironically, actually, the use of the word stress in everyday parlance, I actually think in a weird way is a good thing, because it's good in the sense that it's normalizing it. And I use it normalizing in inverted commas. One of the biggest problems we had for many years was many individuals of all walks of life were afraid to talk about, I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling anxious. And what they would do is they would just ignore it and not cope with it, not deal with it. And we know there was, you know, used to be a stigma around these sorts of things about talking about your mental health issues. Stress is one of the key triggers of mental health, things like depression and anxiety. It's the single biggest cause of long-term illness in the United Kingdom and in many other countries around the world. And so ironically, I think we've done a good thing. We've moved away from hiding away from it, shying away from it. We're opening up about it. We're talking about it. So the more we do that, the better, because it's likely to yield benefits, because it's really important to me. There's a really robust psychological evidence base showing that the more you talk about emotional and traumatic issues in your life, they will, you're more likely to, you'll cope better with them, both psychologically and physiologically.
And just again, on that note, you know, we're seeing huge, I see on LinkedIn now almost every day, where people are out of work and people are looking for work, and the stress and the strain that must place on the individual and their families. You wonder how, one of the things I think the one of the worst things a human being can go through is hopelessness, where there's a perception of there is no hope, because then you start giving up. And it's only when you look back on your life and you think, you know, when I was in that period, you might have felt a level of hopelessness, but it, you know, things work out eventually. But whilst you're in that moment, how does one pull themselves out, extract themselves out of that moment where it's even hard to appraise the environment in a rational way, because you're caught up in so much of that hopelessness at the time? Because, you know, I've lost my job and I'm competing with thousands of people out there, the world's in a mess. And how does one do that?
I mean, there's so many different issues in what you're saying. And it can be unpackaged in so many different ways. But let's maybe just begin with the thing which concerns me most about the current pandemic and just also generally about the likelihood of high levels of unemployment coming up. So, you know, it's likely come October, November that there's going to be this major spike in unemployment as well as possibly second waves of the pandemic. And probably one of the biggest stressors someone can encounter in their life is losing their job. This has such a cascading, devastating negative impact on every aspect of how they live, from their identity right through their financial status, right through to self-esteem. And you're right, it has huge implications for hopelessness. And in fact, we've done a great deal of work on hopelessness over the years, you know, over many years. And what we know is, sadly, that hopelessness and unemployment as a major stressor are a really strong predictor of things like suicide ideation and suicide more generally. And we also know that as individuals experience these chronic levels of stress, which unemployment can be one, you know, some people think, oh, you're unemployed, that's fine, you've no work demands. It's completely incorrect. The idea of not having a job, having no income, and all the stressors that cascades. The way I see it, you have these major life stressors happen. And then all these other stressors cascade from those life events. And every one of them are attacking you in a way which is overwhelming. But what we do know that individuals under those circumstances, it disrupts many aspects, both of those three key things. It disrupts how you feel. So your thoughts, your affect processes. So this is your depression, your anxiety, thing even like irritability, anger, all those things around that. It impacts negatively on how you behave. It often is associated with negative things like increases if you're an alcohol drinker, increases in alcohol consumption, or a smoker, increases smoking, caffeine, but also disrupts all healthy eating. Often people end up having really very maladaptive and unhealthy diets. But also what we've shown in our work, it also disrupts basic biological processes. You know, one of the key biological processes that keeps us alive, it's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This is the stress response system. And this is a negative feedback system, which basically it's the brain and the body interacting and telling us, you know, it's a fundamental biological process that keeps us alive. And what we've shown in our work, and others have shown as well many, many times, but we particularly showing how major stressors disrupt the basic biological processes, and in particular, the release of the stress hormone, which is called cortisol. And it means that the system ends up breaking. And as a result, that means, so as well as the psychological, the behavioral, there's also the physiological response. All of these things can become damaged or blunted or maladaptive. And as a result of that, these things conspire, and that contributes to hopelessness and other related factors. And my concerns are that situations like that over time can be damaging for health, well-being, but also associated increases links with suicide, hopelessness, depression, and anxiety.
But on that then, I mean, I guess the relationship with those three elements is probably two ways. So actually what you're saying there is the physiological, if we were to try and focus on in that moment on our physiological, where we try and exercise, refrain from being sucked into what our bodies or you know, that we're trying to be sucked into from the stress perspective, we could probably try and change our mindset to a degree, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's many different things. I mean, this brings me back to one of my, I suppose, my central mantras as a stress researcher and the thing that I've been trying to promote over the last number of years, which is about being stress aware. It's the idea of being aware of both the fact that stressors can impact you in these really very small and very large ways, but which can be damaging over time. But one of the key things that there's lots that we can do to try and help ourselves cope. So there's this idea that I like this notion of having a psychological toolbox, and where we have many different tools and techniques that we can use to help ourselves cope differently and respond differently to stressors. So one good example comes to mind, which is many people, particularly in the work environment, they have work they go to work and then they let work infiltrate home life. And the idea is that they spend a lot of time worrying and ruminating. So worry and rumination are really important. And in fact, we call this, as stress researchers, we call that perseverative cognition. And what we know, and this is really kind of concerning because many people aren't aware of this, is that we know that there's lots of noxious events that we encounter in our environments. They could be work stressors, they could be life events, they could be, you know, things like, you know, death of a spouse, separation. It could be small things about being late for a meeting or not giving a very good presentation. But what the problem is that those stresses over time, as I've indicated, can have an impact on biology, and they can impact on health status. But one of the things how we these stressors have the impact on these health outcomes is through things like worry and rumination, perseverative cognition. And the concern is that what we were learning now is that worry and rumination are possibly one of the two key variables which link your environment in terms of stress to your health status. And so the idea that when something happens, you'll find yourself worrying a lot about it, ruminating a lot about it. But people aren't aware of that. They're not aware. What they're doing is, whilst they're worrying about it, they're switching on the stress response system, the biological response and the behavioral response and the psychological response to the stressor. The stressor may be no longer present. So that's why the work environment is a great example. You have a really bad interaction with your boss in a meeting. What you should do is you should not let that spill into non-work time. So what I often do is I encourage people to engage what I call worry postponement, where you go, right, so you get people to, part of their toolbox, they go, right, what am I going to do? So when I have that thought and worry and rumination come back into my head, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, right, stop worrying. And I'm going to not worry about that now and decide on a time every night. And you might be three or four hours before you go to bed. You might say, at 7 o'clock tonight, I'm going to have 20 minutes where I'm going to sit down and I'm going to worry about those events. And we know that worry postponement as a technique is a really useful way of reducing worry and rumination, which is likely to yield benefits. So there's lots of things you can do like that. There's time management, being aware. You know, one of the biggest stressors in our lives is poor time management. But one of the best ways of dealing with that is planning, forming if-then plans. And psychologists call these implementation intentions. So it's the idea that you might identify, it increases the likelihood to engage in certain behaviors so you can plan better. And by doing these sorts of things, we know it can help mitigate the negative effects of stress.
In a way, it's like organizations go through strategy. You know, when they're defining their strategy, they go through a scenario planning, and they'll go through the if-then events. And it's in the same way, I guess. Yeah. One of the things that while you were sharing that, I went through fairly early on in my career. I had a really insightful leader, a manager. And she introduced me to the concept of reflective practice. And it was just to change my life and I didn't even feel I was stressed. But she saw things in the way I was working. You know, I was missing lunch. I was doing long days, loving work, but I was in the state of flow, the other end of it, where, you know, you're suffering burnout. And the reflective practice was just a fantastic way of just getting out of my head and on paper what was going, you know, it allowed me to take the churning and to convert it into learning. And I could park it and walk away. So, yeah, that really resonates.
No, absolutely. And the other thing which is important, just to following up from that, Amit, is what we also know is things like getting people to write about stressful events is really beneficial. So it's a bit like your reflective practice, where so there's a really well-known paradigm known as the written emotional disclosure paradigm, in which you get people to write for 15 or 20 minutes each day. In fact, often used in these studies, you used to do it for 3 or 4 consecutive days. But you can do write about the things that are concerning them or stressing them out. And actually by doing that, it allows you, A, to share privately the concerns, but also allows you to work through some of the concerns and then to reflect upon them. And there's another approach which is called the guided disclosure protocol. And it does similar to what you've just mentioned, which is it gets people, A, to identify what's causing the stressor, but reflect on it and think, well, what can I do differently? And in fact, many aspects of interventions that psychologists use do exactly that. It gets you to, and it's the heart of many aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy, it gets people to think differently, reappraise triggers which are stressful, and actually think, how can I learn from this? I mean, it's interesting, there's a whole area as well on reflection in the context of brooding and rumination. So what we know is that rumination is seen as being damaging for us, right? But actually, it's not all rumination that's damaging. It's only what's called brooding, which is the really negative, repetitive thinking that you engage in following stressful and other events. And actually, what would be good is that people who've got a propensity to brood, what you can do is you get them, instead of to think negatively, you think positively. So you reappraise, you think, well, actually, if that event happens to me again, so in your reflection, you think, well, what would I do differently? What strategies would I engage in? And actually, again, it's same as your reflective practice. That will help people cope in a much more positive way. But the other thing I think, which I think is important to flag, is this whole movement towards mindfulness and another therapy, which is known as ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And both of these approaches, in fact, I've got to be honest, earlier in my career, I was quite suspicious of mindfulness in terms of the robust scientific basis around it. But actually, over the last number of years, it's become really very robust, I would argue. I mean, there's clear evidence, actually, for the robustness of many of these different techniques, particularly, and mindfulness comes to mind. So we know that if it's used properly and people adhere to it, that it does yield benefit to, you know, psychological outcomes and to physiological, biological outcomes. And that's what's particularly impressive to me, is to see that convergence in the evidence base showing that it is beneficial.
I mean, Daryl, within the time we've had, you've shared so much insight, and you know, you're a friend to the organization. You've been working with us for a number of years now, and every time I always pull out more and more information from you, and you are an absolute expert. I can't thank you enough for all the insights you shared. Hopefully now, whether it's organizations, whether it's leaders, managers, or whether it's individuals who find themselves in a position of uncertainty in terms of work, there'll be something in what you've shared today that will really help people to understand how they get through, how they make the, you know, reappraise the environment, I guess, around them.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the bottom line with every one of us experiences stress. Every one of us becomes anxious. Every one of us could be at risk of not coping well with stressful events. But the key thing, to my mind, is be stress aware. Actually, and if people want, if they Google my name and also the stress aware, they'll download my there's a recent blog that I've written on all these sorts of issues, and also give 10 top tips on how people can cope better with stress. But key point is, be stress aware. Don't be afraid to reach out to friends, colleagues, and to acknowledge that sometimes it's okay to be stressed, and accept the fact that life can be tough. But the key point is to reappraise, get back on the horse, so to speak, and all will be fine if we are aware and respond to these risks that we all face.
Perfect. And with the support of whether it's leaders, managers, and our friends around us. So thank you, Daryl. Thank you so much for sharing everything you can on stress and insights. No doubt we will have you back again, because there's so much more research I'm sure you're undertaking over at Leeds University. So thank you very much. So that's Daryl O'Connor. We've been talking about stress. Thank you, Daryl.
So that's all from this week's podcast. Please join us again every week when we'll have some fantastic guests talking about employee engagement, leadership development, and everything else in between. Amrit Sander from The Engagement Coach. I will see you soon. Take care.
The Engagement Coach Podcast.